He's talking to you.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Tuesday, February 25th meeting of the Senate Committee on Rules. Committee members, you'll notice that our usual staff, Erin Seiler, is not with us right now because she is staffing House Rules down the hall at the moment. So we have the capable Patrick Brennan, who is our backup, and we're well prepared. So I think we'll take these bills a little bit out of order because I do see Senator Manus Anderson in the room, and I think you're here for HCR 202. Okay, so let's start by opening a public hearing on House Concurrent Resolution 202. And Patrick, you want to tell us about this one?
Thank you, Manager. I will. House Concurrent Resolution 202 recognizes and honors Sergeant Scott Collins and Reserve Deputy Mark Whitehead for their service to the state. We have no amendments before us for this measure. It has no fiscal or revenue impact. So that's what I have for you, Manager.
Great. Senator Manus Anderson, welcome to Senate Rules.
Thank you, Senator Rosenbaum, Vice Chair Senator Farioli, and Senator Starr for bringing this House Concurrent Resolution 202 to a hearing. I bring this to you to recognize Reserve Sergeant Scott Collins and Reserve Deputy Mark Whitehead. 21 years ago tomorrow, Deputy Mark Whitehead and Reserve Sergeant Scott Collins were killed when their patrol car was struck by a drunk driver on I-84 in my district, just east of 181st. The drunk driver was actually traveling in the opposite direction on I-84 when he lost control of his car at an estimated 105 miles per hour, and the vehicle went airborne, and it sheared off the top of the patrol car, and both deputies and the other driver, who had a legal limit three times over the legal limit, they were all killed instantly. And these two deputies were the first reserve officers to be killed in the line of duty. And I have brought Under Sheriff Tim Moore from Multnomah County, who will say a few words. But it's very important, I think, for us to honor these two men.
Thank you for bringing it to us, Sheriff.
Good morning. I'm Under Sheriff Tim Moore from the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. Thank you for hearing from me today. I'm here representing Sheriff Dan Staton and on behalf of the surviving families of Reserve Deputies Collins and Whitehead. Throughout the state, Sheriff's Office's services are enhanced by volunteer Sheriff's Deputies. As I'm sure you're aware, their training and qualifications are identical to a compensated police officer, the only difference being they're volunteering their time. This tragedy on February 26, 1993, left a mark on the families, the agency, and the community that's still felt today. The deputies who were involved as the investigators and responding deputies are now through our agency in management roles, including our current sheriff who responded that night. Adopting HCR 202 will trigger the ODOT process of erecting a roadside memorial paid for with private funds to honor the sacrifice of these two public servants. There will be a constant reminder of the sacrifice these deputies made, a reminder of the tragedies created by drunk driving, and a visual reminder of the love and appreciation from the community to their public servants. Thank you for holding a public hearing on this resolution. Both our Sheriff's Office and Sheriff's Offices across the state stand ready to assist any way that's necessary, and we urge the Senate to adopt this resolution. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you for your testimony, and obviously we're still very sorry for the loss both to the state and the families. So I think this is highly appropriate that we honor them in this way, and I had forgotten that this would enable us to move forward with a roadside memorial too. So any questions for these good folks or for the senator, who is also a good folk? Okay, thank you both for your testimony and for bringing this to us. And there's no one else signed up to testify on HCR 202, so I'll close the public hearing, open a work session on HCR 202.
Madam Chair, I move HCR 202 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Thank you, Senator Ferrioli has moved HCR 202 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries. We'll ask Senator Montes Anderson to be our carrier on the floor, and I'll close the work session on HCR 202. And I'll open a public hearing on Senate Resolution 201. Patrick?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Resolution 201 designates Clatsop Community College as Oregon's Maritime College. We have in our position as well, and I believe you've been provided, it's on OLIS and before you, on hard copy, the Dash 1 Amendment. It names Clatsop Community. Oh, that is what the Dash 1 Amendment does, Madam Chair. Or is that what the Dash 1 Amendment does? Or is there a Dash 1 Amendment, Madam Chair?
You're asking me? I have quite a bit of paper here, but
perhaps we could ask our witness.
Right. So I don't have a Dash 1 Amendment.
I don't see a Dash 1 Amendment either. But there is one somewhere.
Okay.
Or so Aaron tells me.
We have Larry Galizio here to testify, as well as Jessica Adamson. Yes, why don't you all come forward?
Yeah, I don't see it. Yeah, I don't either. It's not in here. It's not in our packet.
Oh, I see. So, we'll look forward to hearing your testimony, but does anybody know, is there a Dash 1 Amendment? Because we don't have it.
So, Madam Chair, Senators, I believe the Dash 1 Amendment would just be one word in the title of the resolution between the words maritime and college. You would put the word training, and
it's just that I think Patrick's looking for it right now.
Okay.
Maybe to see where it is. Maybe it's been requested but hasn't come back yet, because our staff measure summary does refer to it. And our usual committee administrators tied up in another hearing at the moment. So why don't we just go ahead and, in whatever order you want to go, just testify to the bill.
Again, thank you, Madam Chair, Senators. Appreciate the opportunity. I'm very pleased to be here on behalf of Clatsop Community College, and very pleased to be here with my colleague at Clatsop, Captain Bill Antilla, who's been at the college for 19 years, and he's the lead of our Maritime Sciences program, and he's in his 35th year as a licensed captain. So this is going to be highly uncharacteristic of a college president. I'm going to be brief and really turn it over to Captain Antilla. But although resolutions are largely symbolic, this resolution is important for several reasons. One is, ultimately, we see this as helping provide some economic growth, not just for Clatsop County, but actually for the state. And again, we'll get into that. Second, it will increase the awareness both within Oregon, throughout Oregon, and then outside of Oregon of this training resource that we have. I mean, last year we had students from over 30 states come to Clatsop Community College's maritime program to update their licensure and to do training. Third, it will recognize the designation that we received, and we're the only community college in the United States that we believe has received this Coast Guard designation as a training ship school, and again, Captain Antilla can explain more. And then finally, adopting this resolution will provide a catalyst and another reason for our federal delegation in Washington, D.C. to make a change to federal law, because ultimately our goal is for this maritime program to be designated Oregon's Maritime Academy, and we'll explain what that means. So the college's Maritime Academy and the campus on which it sits was built in 1968 with federal dollars. And we want to capitalize on the growing maritime economy, and we believe this resolution will put the state's imprimatur on an important industry and will help the college both within Oregon and throughout. So with that, thank you very much.
Great. Thanks for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, committee members. In speaking with President Galizio...
Could you just say your name for the record?
Bill Antilla. Larry said I'm one of the senior faculty at the department. In speaking with President Galizio about what types of things we need to explain, it seemed to me that rather than explain why Clatsop College should be designated as a maritime college, the real question is why should Oregon designate a maritime college? We could argue that we train people to have jobs. The truth is every program in every community college and professional technical program trains people for jobs. The real difference is we create jobs in a very real sense. When we send a graduate out, because of the global nature of maritime shipping, we can have someone living in Ontario going out, a starting job as a deckhand pays $65,000 to $70,000 a year. They stay here, they pay taxes, they bring new dollars back into the economy. By the time they're up 5-6 years into their career, they're making six figures. We didn't have to build infrastructure. We don't have to create anything. We're just bringing new money back. Right now, the U.S. fleet is about 20% short of able-bodied seamen, which is the rating which people graduate from our programs with an average age of 55. There's a huge demand for this. What we are looking for in terms of getting a designation to help us accomplish this is a couple of different things. First is recognition. When someone says, well, you could go to a community college and take a few classes, there's a sense that it's a night class, it's a basket weaving class. Recognition as a designated school in maritime would certainly help us provide more mariners and provide some of our kids graduating very, very good careers. By the time you get to the top of the profession, say as a pilot, pilot starts at about $350,000 a year, and they work 6 months out of the year. The other is, as President Galizia said, there is existing legislation on the federal level through the Maritime Education Act that allows each state to have one designated maritime academy that receives federal support. Recognition by the state would allow us to move one step closer to pursuing that and bringing federal dollars in to help support our training the people in this state and providing these jobs. When we're talking about the training academy, what it means is that had some medical work done recently. When we start bringing people in, normally to become an able-bodied seaman, which is what our graduates are, they have to accumulate 360 days at sea, which takes 2 to 3 years to accomplish. Then they come back, go through extensive training, certification. It's very, very difficult to get a job with no previous experience or skills. With the approval we have, someone can come in straight out of high school, graduate with their associate, and all their documents to go to work as an able seaman. And as I said, starting salary is around $65,000 a year, and there's jobs available. And regardless of where they live, they can still go out, work, and come home. We need this federal program to help us step up in recruitment. It also would provide significant federal dollars to help us support what we do. As we're moving forward with this, I understand this is not going to accomplish that, but it would certainly move us forward with that agenda. Is there any questions that I can answer for you?
I think we'll hear from all of you, and then we'll open it up for questions. Thanks for your testimony.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson, representing the Columbia River Pilots, and we just want to add our voice in support of this resolution. Clatsop Community College is an important training center for the maritime industry in Oregon, and we, as practitioners in the maritime industry, as pilots, are very appreciative of the work that they do and supportive of the work they do, and appreciate the resolution and the designation that it would create for Clatsop Community College. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you all for your testimony. And now, are there any questions for these good folks? I wanted to just ask, how many students are there in this program?
Let me give you two different numbers. Degree students. This year's cohort of degree students was around 20. But we also do ongoing education for the industry, such as the pilots. And there's hundreds and hundreds of people. The nature of what we do is very intensive. A 40-hour class is not Monday, Wednesday, Friday from noon to 1 for the term. It's 8 to 5 Monday through Friday because people have jobs. They need to get in and get out. We also have very unique schedules in that we don't have a schedule on many classes. The door is open. People come in. They study when they are off the vessel. They get back on the vessel. They come back in. So we're teaching one-on-one. It's a very moving number, Madam Chair. I apologize for not being able to give you hard numbers. I can tell you, let's see, in the last 7.5, 8 years in the safety class, I've taught 2,090 people.
Wow.
And that's all required to work. Also, of the Columbia River pilots, two of the pilots started with us out of high school, got their degree straight out of high school, and I believe there's 9 or 10 pilots that got their degree as an assist to getting into the program.
Very impressive. Go
ahead. Madam Chair, Senators, one point I wanted to make, or 2 points that I failed to make. Number one is we communicated with all of the other community colleges in Oregon and universities to make sure there was no conflict. And then secondly, CLATSUP is the only maritime training college in the state of Oregon. So I think those are important points I wanted to make.
Great. Any other questions or comments? Okay, well, thank you very much. And former Representative Galicia, it's nice to see you back in the Capitol.
Thank you very much.
We miss you.
Okay, so I'll close the public hearing on SR 201, open a work session on SR 201. In the meantime, we did find the Dash 1 amendment, which there should be a copy of in front of everybody, right?
Yes.
Which just is a little, I think, drafting correction.
Madam Chair, we're suspending the rules because the amendment wasn't available for 1 hour before the hearing. Is that...
Well, we could carry the bill over if we don't want to suspend the rules. This is really not a substantive change, though, so it's up to you.
Madam Chair, I was hoping I could watch you do the first conceptual change in the legislative session.
I wouldn't dare.
Come on. It's the Senate Secretary's last week. I mean, come on. Give him something
make
to
him
do.
Make him earn his pay.
Yeah, make him come run it down here.
I think we should probably follow the script or just carry it over till tomorrow if we would prefer.
Madam Chair, I see no reason why not to accommodate the Chair since she's been so accommodating to her members.
Great. Thanks.
I'm sure I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on the Dash 1 amendment to SR 201. Without, Madam Chair, do I really have to say without having the 1 hour posting, without having the required 1 hour posting?
Thank you. Senator Farrioli, Vice Chair Farrioli moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on the Dash 1 amendment to SR 201 without having the required 1 hour posting. Is there objection to his motion?
Madam Chair, I think we ought to note for the record, this is a one-word clarification, training. And since I'm much in favor of training.
The staff is reminding me that this is not a debatable motion, so it wouldn't matter.
That wasn't a debate, Madam Chair.
So we're on the suspension of the rules. Is there objection? Okay. Rules are suspended. Now do we have to move the amendment, right?
I'm trying to move the SR 201 as amended to the floor with the B adopted.
First.
I beg your pardon, Madam Chair. We only just suspended the rules. Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to SR 201 with a B adopted recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Farrioli has moved the Dash 1 amendment to SR 201. Is there any objection to his motion? I should have said, is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Okay, motion carries. Amendment is adopted. Senator Farrioli.
Madam Chair, move SR 201 is amended to the floor with a B adopted recommendation.
Thank you. Vice Chair Farrioli moves SR 201 as amended to the floor with a B adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Okay, motion carries. And Senator Johnson, who couldn't be here this morning, is the chief sponsor of this and I know has done a lot of work on it. So we'll ask her to be our carrier on the floor. And I'll close the work session on SR 201.
If you would like to have your regular staff background, sure. As soon as that went...
Okay, well, thank you, Patrick, for pinch-hitting. And wait a moment, and we have our regular committee administrator back in her usual spot. No problem. We managed.
Thank you, Patrick.
I'm ready. And I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4056.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4056 prohibits county clerk or county recording officer from recording document that records death filed in conjunction with owning or having owned interest in land if document originated in this state and includes medical information relating to cause of death. There is an emergency clause on the measure. You do have a dash 2 amendment. It specifies Section 1 applies to documents recorded a death that occurred on or after January 1st, 2014.
Okay, thanks a lot, Erin. And it looks like we have Rob Bovet here to testify, if you'd like to come forward. Good morning and welcome back to Senate Rules.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rob Bovet, legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties, here today representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks. House Bill 4056 is a very important technical correction bill for families all around Oregon, and I'll try to keep this brief. We need to be able to record death certificates in the deed records. When a family member passes, in order to clear title and pass title, that death certificate has to be recorded in the deed records. Last year, you passed a comprehensive omnibus bill that adopted the Model Act, the new Model Act for Vital Statistics, which is great. That's fine. The problem is, well, one piece of that Model Act basically says clerks shouldn't be recording what are called long-form death certificates, death certificates with protected health information on them. And that's fine in Oregon. We've adopted the Model Act. We have short-form death certificates, which can and should be recorded. Unfortunately, not all states have adopted the Model Act. California and Washington are two examples. So if you have a family member who owns title in Oregon to property who passes away in California or Washington, you can't get a short-form death certificate and you can't record the long-form certificate, so you're basically stuck. So since January 1st, we've had lots of families in Oregon who've had a family member pass away that owns title in another state, and they can't record the death certificate, and so they're truly stuck. So House Bill 4056 simply clarifies that our clerks can go back to recording long-form certificates from other states so families aren't stuck in this lurch. There is a dash 2 amendment, which a couple of our county clerks and county councils would like you to adopt. It just clarifies the starting date, which we're fine with. So we would ask you to adopt the dash 2 amendments and pass the bill as amended. It comes to you unopposed from the House, of course. Again, this is very important we get this taken care of so families aren't stuck in a lurch. I have read the testimony of the person who signed up to oppose the bill. I fear that she doesn't quite understand what the bill does, and she somehow believes it has something to do with elections, which it doesn't. We're talking about recording death certificates in the deed records. So if you have a family member that passes away that doesn't own property, you're not going to record that death certificate in the deed records, and it truly has nothing to do with elections. So happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for Mr. Bovet? Okay, thanks a lot. And perhaps if you could stay with
stay
us.
Right there. You bet.
You don't need to stay at the witness table, but just in case other questions do come up. Okay, and we have one other person signed up to testify, and Janice Deisinger, would you like to come forward? Welcome back to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rosenbaum and members of the committee, honorable senators. In my testimony, I told you about an experience I had this last year finding voters who had died on the voter rolls. And I had learned back in So I won't go over all that. You can look at my testimony if you want to see the experience I had. So I reported a number of people that were on the voter rolls that had died according to the Social Security Master Death List. So earlier in 2000, I think it was 2010, we went to our county commissioners and we had found a law that said the county recording officer was supposed to tell the county clerk when a person had died, and those people were to be immediately taken off the voter rolls. And since I found a number of people that were still on the voter rolls that were dead according to the Social Security Master Death List, I just want to clarify that this law will not prohibit, if someone turns in any death certificate, from it being recorded. You could redact the medical information if you need to, but I just want to make sure that those deaths are recorded so that so the elections division will be able to take those people off of the voter rolls. And the gentleman here from the Association of County Clerks says, I don't understand it, and I'm not an attorney, but from when I read the law, this amendment, it brought question to me thinking that there were possibility of some recordings not being done. So just ask you to clarify that for me.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Any questions?
Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Senator Friel.
It's not really a question. It's just that I don't know that it's necessary for any witness to comment on the level of understanding of any other witness's testimony. I think it's up to the members of the committee to judge for ourselves. But I think it's fair to assert that people are concerned about proper maintenance of the voter registration roll. That's a legitimate concern. And that if there are folks that are still voting after their demise, it confirms some suspicions that one of the things that's guaranteed is the right to vote even after the people pass. That's been a common feature of voter fraud wherever it's occurred. So I certainly understand the concern. I guess for the record, I appreciate the statement that nothing in this law relieves the county clerk from the obligation to remove deceased voters from the voter roll. So we just state that for the record. And I think that does at least a little to allay the concern that for whatever reason death certificates are not being recorded, ergo they're not being, dead voters are not being purged from the rolls. I see this as a way to solve that problem. You know, get the death certificates recorded, respect the privacy of the decedent by not disclosing medical information, and remove the obstacle to the clerk doing their duty, which is remove dead voters from the voter registration rolls. So I think all those things are legitimate concerns. I've just asserted that for the record. I'll do that again on the Senate floor. But I intend to not only respect the legitimate concerns of folks who are watching the voter, the voting registration process, but also to respect the decedent's rights to privacy by solving this problem. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your comments and for the clarification. Anyone else? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. And we don't have anyone else signed up to testify on this bill, so I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4056 and open a work session on House Bill 4056.
Madam Chair.
Senator Farioli.
I move to adopt the -2 amendment to House Bill 4056.
Vice Chair Farioli has moved the -2 amendment to House Bill 4056. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Any objection to the amendment? Okay, motion carries. Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4056 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Farioli has moved House Bill 4056 to the floor as amended with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, motion carries. And I see that Senator Boquist is the only Senate sponsor of this bill, so I think we'll ask him to be our carrier. And
he brought us the -2 amendment as well.
So I'm sure he's working on it. Okay, great. So we'll ask Senator Boquist to be our carrier, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 4056. And we have one bill remaining, so I will open a public hearing on House Bill 4133A. Erin, would you like to tell us about this one?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 4133A directs Legislative Council and Oregon Department of Justice to review statute laws and identify those that are outdated, obsolete, or duplicative of other laws. It authorizes Legislative Council, in consultation with the Department of Justice, to prepare measures for odd-numbered year regular session to repeal or amend statutes so identified. Requires report explaining reason for statutory modification to accompany each measure and be included in legislative record. It limits amendments to measures drafted under these provisions. It sunsets on January 2nd, 2018. There is an emergency clause on the measure. You have two amendments before you this morning. You have the Dash A2 amendment, which removes limitations on amendments, and the Dash A3 amendment, which requires a required report for prepared measures be distributed to senators and representatives and otherwise made available to the public at least 90 days prior to start of legislative session at which measure is to be considered. There is a no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact on the underlying measure. There is the same on the Dash A2 amendment. We do not have paperwork on the Dash A3 amendment. This measure does come to you from the House floor with a 31-26-4 vote.
Okay, thanks, Erin. And I see our Legislative Counsel, Dexter Johnson. Are you here to testify or just answer questions? So if you'd like to come forward, and it looks like you have Leonie Reeves from the Governor's Office.
And Steve Wolf.
Great. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee. Whoever wants to go first.
Good morning, Chair Rosenbaum, Vice Chair Verrilli, members of the committee. My name is Leonie Reeves, and I'm General Counsel to Governor Kitzhaber. Thank you for hearing our testimony on House Bill 4133. I just want to talk briefly about sort of what the bill does and then answer a couple of questions prospectively about the bill. So the goal of the bill, as stated in the bill, is to identify statutes that can be repealed by the legislature in a future session, and those are bills that are outdated, obsolete, or duplicative. So just a little bit about the type of bills that we're looking, or the type of statutes that we're looking to get repealed. These are not just grammatical changes or things that can be changed with the Scrivener's bill, and these are not policy changes that are actually sort of making policy decisions in statutes. But these are bills that are on the books and the many volumes of the Oregon revised statutes that have been identified through this process as being obsolete or outdated. And some examples of the types of statutes that might be at issue in future sessions to be potentially repealed by the legislature are pilot programs that are no longer they have expired, loan or tax credits that no longer are actually used or on the books. Again, these are things that are outdated, obsolete, or duplicative, not meant to make any substantive or policy change. What the bill does is sets up a process, a collaborative process between the Legislative Council's office and the Department of Justice to review the laws and prepare a report to the legislature explaining why the statute could be repealed by the legislature, and then ultimately the legislature would decide whether or not to repeal those statutes. I want to talk a little bit about the history of the bill. This started as a governor's office process where we worked with some executive branch agencies to try to identify some of these statutes that we considered outdated, obsolete, or duplicative. We brought a short list to Legislative Council's office as sort of these are the types of statutes that we're looking at, and Legislative Council properly expressed some concerns about both the timing and whether or not this was something that could be done in a short session, and also just the process of identifying those bills. We went back and we tried to cull the list a little bit more and came back with yet another list of types of statutes that we believed were outdated or obsolete. And again, Legislative Council suggested an alternative process to get this done in a longer session, and that is what the product of House Bill 4133 is. So House Bill 4133 is really the process articulated by the Legislative Council's office in consultation with the Governor's office to set up this collaborative process between the executive branch and the legislative branch to identify these types of statutes and then bring them forward in the longer sessions for legislative consideration. One question that's come up is sort of what is the purpose of the bill? I mean, do we really need statute to do this process? And I think the short answer is no. There would be nothing that would prevent agencies or the Legislative Council's office to work and do that work and identify statutes, but it hasn't been done to date. So the bill really is sort of just trying to provide a bit of energy and inertia to get this process started and to do it in a coordinated way between the legislature and the executive branch, and really to come up with a collaborative process that's a little bit more reasoned and deliberate, and really provide some inertia to getting this process done that is frankly long overdue. So I'm going to let others comment on, and I'm certainly happy to answer any questions.
Great. And did you have any comment on these amendments, or?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Governor's Office doesn't have any concerns with either the Dash 2 or the Dash 3 amendments.
And did you?
I'm happy to go. Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, I'm Steve Wolf, Chief Counsel of the General Counsel Division of the Department of Justice. And mostly here to answer questions, but also I think to echo a couple of the observations that Ms. Reeves made, that particularly with regard to the history of this proposal, I think there have been efforts in fits and starts over several years to try to get a mechanism going to identify some of the really what we're looking at is the dead wood and brush clearing in the ORSs, and for one reason or another these haven't worked particularly well, and so that this bill, as I understand it, is an effort to systematize a process to sort of codify a partnership between DOJ and Legislative Council to work together to identify laws that might be candidates for removal, and do that in a systematic way over the next couple of regular sessions in order to see if there is some significant body of laws that can be removed, and whether they are laws that the legislature would agree should be removed. With regard to the proposed amendments, DOJ has no problems with them or comments with them.
Thank you. Dexter.
Chair Rosenbaum, good morning. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council. And I completely agree with the testimony that Ms. Reeves and Mr. Wolf just provided you. This bill is intended to fill a gap between the revisor's bill, which you're all familiar with. This is last session's example, which corrects errors that are Scrivener errors that no one could argue one way or the other as anything except that, and policy bills which you consider in the regular course of things, including policy bills that the executive branch brings before you through the agency bill request process that is existing law. There is, however, a substantial gap there, and this bill is designed to address that in a way that is a little bit more systematic than the current process. And let me outline for you the current process, at least from what LC has done over the years. When we see that there is some kind of a problem with the statute, in our opinion, we make a note of it. We use a form, actually. This is an example of a collection of statutes that we've identified as problematic, and we have actually several binders worth of these forms. And we note them on our bill drafting system. They are also notated so that when you request a bill and it contains, in order to achieve whatever it is you want, there is a opportunity to amend the particular statute that we've identified has a problem, we will often put in that correction, talk to you about it. But I think you've all experienced this, where you've requested a bill and, oh, you get it, and there's this other thing in there, and you're wondering, where did that come from? And so this process it proposes to make that approach a little bit more systematic so that you're not surprised that the bill you requested contains this other little baggage along with it. So that is the intent behind the bill. As Mr. Wolf suggested, there have been previous attempts at this kind of work. The last significant attempt that I'm aware of was in 2001 or 1999-2001, where Legislative Council, I think it was less formally than this, but we partnered with DOJ and others in developing and putting before you bills that would do this kind of cleanup. Necessarily, those kind of bills have to have a broad relating clause. And what happened in that experience was that those bills became vehicles for other proposals that could not...
Shocking, Madam Chair.
...could not stand on their own. And so that ended up derailing the whole process, essentially. And so that is the purpose of Section 2 of the bill, which is to ensure that only those statutory changes that both Legislative Council and Department of Justice believe are duplicative can be addressed in the bill. There's nothing that would prevent the legislature from removing those if the legislature felt that, in fact, those statutes still needed to be on the books. But it would prevent the legislature from using these kinds of bills as vehicles for other proposals. I will also note, however, that, as you all know, the legislature itself has a unique ability to avoid the effect of statutes. And that is to say that there is nothing that would prohibit, if you wanted an amendment to one of these kinds of bills that put something else in it, the first line of that amendment would be, notwithstanding Section 2, et cetera. Section 2 does not apply to sections whatever of the amendment. So it is not a unique process. If you decided to go ahead with this, I certainly would also propose modifying both House and Senate rules to reflect Section 2. That would make it a little bit more difficult, but it would not ultimately prevent you, if you wanted to, from using these kind of measures as vehicles for something else.
So just to clarify, does that complete your testimony?
Yes.
So just to clarify, though, these Dash 2 amendments delete Section 2 of the bill. So they, that limitation then would go away.
Madam Chair, yes, the limitation would go away, and this is would be solely from my perspective, that Section 2 really is the only thing substantive in this bill. Section 1, as Ms. Reeves indicated, under existing law, agencies have the ability to request bills and could do so. So it's really Section 2, from my perspective, is the guts of the bill.
Okay, so we may have some questions for you, so don't go anywhere. And Senator Starr.
Thank you. Support the bill. I think it makes sense. You know, I don't think we need Section 2 because we can get around it easily. I think the idea of putting something in House and Senate rules is interesting, and you know, that's something that the leadership and chambers can discuss. What I do find curious as I look at this is that with all the work that is outlined or expected here, that there's absolutely no fiscal identified in order to accomplish this work. Can you talk to, are we going to do this in the normal course of action and that it doesn't not going to cost anything additional and that there's no fiscal?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Starr, I don't anticipate, the reason LC doesn't have any fiscal is that I would not anticipate hiring any staff to do this. And one of the challenges in Legislative Council is we have to, for staffing purposes, we have to build for the peak periods because that is when the legislature is not a, unlike a conventional business, it's not a steady work, but seasonal work. And so we have to build for those peak periods. And this is something that we can pursue in the off-season, as it were. So that's why there isn't any particular... That's one reason. The other reason is, yes, we've already identified a lot of bills that, in our view, are candidates for this, and I'm sure DOJ has as well. So that's why, from our perspective, there's no fiscal.
Senator Starr, Chair Rosenbaum, I think the answer for DOJ is the same. We think we aren't going to have to engage additional staff to do this. We can do it within our current staffing levels. It'll be a little tricky to work it in, but I think we have a way of structuring it within my office and general counsel that it does not have a fiscal impact.
Great. Thank you.
And Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My understanding is that no one on the panel has objections to inclusion of either amendment.
I didn't hear that. Chair Rosenbaum, that's correct from DOJ's perspective. I think I understand what the purposes of Section 2 in particular, in terms of it being an additional way of imposing rigor on the process, but I think our goal is to just do this within the confines of whatever framework that the legislature wants it to be done. And so,
Madam Chair?
I think there was another response to your question.
Yeah, please do.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Farioli. I'm somewhat constrained. There's a statute that provides that legislative council may not advocate for or against particular measures.
Good. Good. So, thank you, Madam Chair.
I can leave it at that.
Thank you. A couple of questions, Madam Chair. In the evolution of the concept, there were several iterations of lists of things to do, and they were presented for discussion, and those lists got smaller, more focused. And I was just interested in hearing from folks, you know, what was the winnowing process? Why were some things considered political or volatile or not suitable for prime time in terms of including on the list of topics for this winnowing process? Can you speak to that? Can anybody speak to that?
Chair Rosenbaum, Vice Chair Farioli, members of the committee, I think the issue was more of timing and the amount of time that we had in a short session to reach a comfort level that the proposed changes by agencies could be thoroughly vetted, both internally within the executive branch and then certainly with the legislative branch. And so the list of statutes that agencies identified, first of all, we didn't hear back from all agencies, so we didn't have enough time to gather, you know, a full set of data, and then we just didn't have enough time in a short session to really vet that data to make that determination. So I wouldn't say that there was a very conscious, this is too much of a political change versus not. It was just that we didn't have enough time to even have that, have a very intelligent conversation about that.
Okay. Madam Chair, follow up?
Go ahead.
You're describing a process whereby folks in the administration confer with other folks in the administration and sort of nominate a list of obsolete sections. Are you going to seek input from other sources? You know, Oregon has a lot of boards and commissions, and one of the frequent sources I hear for changes, particularly about obsolescence, come from members of boards and commissions that have to deal with requirements for their sector, not necessarily the board or commission itself, but feedback from the sector. Why are we still doing this? You know, it doesn't meet current practices, doesn't serve any useful purpose, it's an artifact in the statutes, but we have to live by the law, so we're still doing this. So are we going to outreach to boards and commissions and ask them about obsolescence and lack of functionality and cost?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Farioli, I think that's a critical part of this process for several reasons, and I think that fortunately in General Counsel at DOJ we're in kind of a uniquely good position to do that since we have contact counsel for all of the chairs and commissions. But I think it's also not only those stakeholders but other stakeholders in the community. We can't, I think... speaking for myself, look at a statute that looks like it might be obsolete or unused and know for a fact that it's not. And so I think that there is a need to engage with stakeholders, again, as I say, both at the agency level and at the community level to determine, well, does this law continue to serve a purpose? And also to get to collect candidate laws from those populations to determine what we ought to be looking at.
And, Madam Chair, just for the record, I'd like to get copies of your correspondence and outreach to the boards and commissions. Ask them for their input.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Farioli, I don't see any problem with doing that, assuming that we do. At this point, the mechanism that we're going to use for that's kind of up in the air, and we'll probably be working with legislative counsel to formulate the entire framework of how we're going to do this.
Even emails.
Yes, certainly.
And, Madam Chair, why was there, I mean, this sounds like a thoughtful, considerate process where people will have several iterations of input and feedback from legislators and from others. Why do we have an emergency clause on this bill?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Farioli, the reason is that absent an emergency clause, this bill would not go into effect until January 1 of 2015, and the bill contemplates the legislation be prepared for the 2015 session and the 2017 session, and then is repealed.
And does this, do you believe that there will be anything in the recommendations involving election law?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farrell, to answer that question would be speculation on my part.
I'm sure I'll speculate. A lot of the statutes in ORS involve polling at a polling place. I mean, there's still a lot of stuff on the books that don't really reflect vote by mail, which I'll remind the panel I supported. So I would expect there will be recommendations about obsolescence. So I can guarantee you that there will be lively input from close observers of the elections process. It's just guaranteed. And, Madam Chair, just an observation, if I might. I think there are 21 volumes of Oregon Revised Statute, so I fully anticipate that at the end of this process, there'll be 23 volumes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
That seems like it would defeat the purpose of the project, Senator Farrell.
How ironic.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, relating to the Dash 2 amendment, if that amendment is adopted, then if someone wants to put something substantive into the bill, there would be no way to really tell the difference between the substantive ones and the unsubstantive ones. Is that correct? I mean, they'd all be kind of presented equally.
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, the only way that there would still be to tell would be that the report prepared, which explains in more ordinary language what is going on in a particular measure prepared under this bill.
But within the measure itself, without that notwithstanding, everything is kind of on an equal basis, right? Well, that's why the Dash 2 amendment concerns me, Madam Chair, is because of transparency. If we're presenting this as a bill, and everyone recognizes that there's always ways the legislature can get around it, but I'd be very uncomfortable with putting something forward that if the legislature is getting around it, I want it to be transparent so that people know, people can look at the measure itself. And Senator Farioli raised the issue of election laws. In that area in particular, it would be very tempting, I think, to try to insert some substantive things in that area of law and other areas of law. And I think just having that requirement that they specifically exempt themselves at least will let the public and the advocates know what's going on. So I would very strongly urge that we take that step toward transparency if we move this bill.
Thank you, Senator Burdick. And I agree with you. I think Section 2 was drafted to reassure everybody that this bill, or if there's more than one, are not going to be used as a gut-and-stuff vehicle to advance things other than removing archaic or obsolete statutes. I think there was, I did not listen to all the testimony, but my understanding is there was testimony on the House side that people thought this should be a vehicle to gut and stuff if somebody wanted to use it that way. My personal opinion is that's not what this is about, though. So,
Madam Chair,
yes, go ahead,
question.
Senator
I'm
Burdick.
Just looking at the -3 amendment, and I apologize for being out of the room a little bit, and I'm just wondering what the purpose of, well, I look at the -3 amendment and I say, would this generate a fiscal?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, I also don't think that the -3 would generate a fiscal. All it calls for is having the report prepared and published, distributed to you all, and put out on the internet 90 days before session. So it would, in fact, increase the assurance level that whatever ends up in the measures prepared under this bill is, in fact, housekeeping. Because if we get a lot of feedback from the public that, we use this statute for this, that, or the other thing, mm-hmm. It would, I think, be the position of both DOJ and LC would not be an appropriate statute to change in this kind of housekeeping measure. So it would increase transparency.
Okay, so then that's a good thing. So to follow up, Madam Chair, if the -3 were in, then would it be would the bill have to somehow be limited to only the things that were out in 90 days, or could it be amended at the last minute with notwithstanding language?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, follow-up question. Are you asking if, the -3 amendments contemplate if the legislature amends a measure that the report also be modified to reflect those amendments? Okay. Does that answer your question?
That does. Thank you.
Additional questions?
Madam Chairman, I have one additional question and an observation. Why the close vote in the House? 31-26. Why? I mean, if this is such a logical thing to do, why is there such a close vote in the?
I mean, I don't know that the witnesses need to explain the vote in the House. I think the legislators who voted can probably explain that for themselves. But if you want to speculate on that, go ahead.
Well, Madam Chair, I can rephrase the question. Rather than speculation, what concerns did you hear expressed regarding the closeness of the vote?
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, the concern I had was that this was perceived, that I had heard, was that this was perceived as a essentially increasing the governor's authority at the expense of the legislature. And I actually think the opposite is true. Under current law, the governor can, through the agency bill request process, request anything that the governor wants, and that doesn't change here. But with respect to these particular measures, they are only going to contain changes that both Legislative Council and DOJ agree are non-substantive housekeeping changes to remove obsolete materials. And so that, from my perspective, it simply doesn't affect the governor's authority at all.
Madam Chair, that was the argument that I heard also, but the argument that I heard was expressed more in terms of the legislative assembly. This assembly can't bind a future assembly, so to suggest that we could say you may not amend a measure that comes from Section 1 because somebody asserts that it was drafted pursuant to obsolescence would be to place unwarranted limitation on the future legislative authority. We can't do that. And as a matter of fact, I would suggest that if Section 2 remains in the bill, you may have legislators asking you to litigate the issue.
And Senator Ferrioli, just to clarify, the limitation in Section 2 isn't that you can't amend the bill. It just says you can't amend the bill in a way that's unrelated to the reason the statute was repealed or amended. So I think what that, and I think Dexter testified to this already, but the reason that language is in there is so what he described earlier isn't going to happen, that this bill with a really broad relating clause becomes a vehicle for anything anybody wants to do that has nothing to do with obsolete statutes. So if we take that out...
I agree with your logic, but here's the problem. Who is it that provides the reason that a statute was repealed? The same people that drafted the bill. So the idea is that if I say it's so, it's so. And you can't revise it or amend it or otherwise add to it. That's the exclusive purview of seated legislators. So, Madam Chair, I would simply say that Section 2, I think, does raise separation of powers issues, but it also is an attempt to limit the authority of a future legislator, which can't be done. So, Madam Chair, I think the Dash 2 is meant not to harm the bill, but to ease its passage. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Well, I mean, Senator Ferrioli raises some reasonable points. I think that's probably why Mr. Johnson suggested that, or recommended that, the House and the Senate rules also be amended to deal with that. And I think it's just, it's probably more kind of to set a tone than anything else. I'm not aware of this, but based on the testimony of what happened in the past, it's probably a good thing to have Section 2 in there, even if it's not enforceable.
Madam Chair, I can almost guarantee that it'll be litigated.
Okay, any further questions or discussion?
Okay. Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Stark.
Yeah, so, you know, this measure contemplates DOJ and Legislative Council coming up with a draft, which I assume will be introduced probably through a legislative committee. That draft will be something that the legislature will have and the next legislature will have at its disposal. In the event that someone, one of us or a future legislator, wants to amend that bill, you will then have a engrossed version if that person is successful with amendments. It's not like that process happens in secret. And I just don't see a need to include the Section 2 in this bill for transparency reasons, because whatever we do in this building is broadcast worldwide on the internet. Every vote that we cast, virtually every word that we say is recorded, and I agree that this legislature can't bind the next legislature, and I really question the value of having Section 2 in the bill if we really want to move this in a strong bipartisan vote. When you look at the vote in the House, I think the primary issue was that inclusion of Section 2. It's not necessary, and our proponents of the bill support removing it. I don't know why we need to leave it in, unless you want to have a partisan fight for some reason on this measure. I just don't see a reason to do it that way.
Okay, anybody else?
Just here's an irony, another irony. I love it, irony. So the Legislative Assembly or a committee of the Legislative Assembly may not amend a legislative measure described in Section 1 so as to add material that is unrelated to the reason a statute repealed or amended by the measure was identified under the section. If that, so the only people that can really amend are the folks in control of making the recommendations. That would be the Department of Justice and Legislative Council. So there may be reasons to amend, as we know no perfect product ever arrives at a committee. So are you suggesting that the measures could be amended but only by DOJ representatives or by Legislative Council?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Ferrioli, no, only a legislative committee can amend the bill. I think what Section 2 contemplates is if, in fact, there is change proposed in a measure prepared under this bill, that in the very transparent legislative process, it comes to light that, in fact, this is a not an obsolete statute, then the legislature can amend it out.
Thank you.
Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I think Senator Ferrioli is missing part of the language here. It's not that the legislature can't amend the bill. It's that they can't amend it to add to the bill items that aren't otherwise covered or related to that. So it's fairly restricted. I think the contemplation is that they could add. The legislature could disagree with the judgment of the council coming forward and say, no, we don't want to take that out. It's just that you couldn't add new stuff in this bill, which doesn't limit the legislature, because we certainly have the authority to add stuff through new legislation.
Madam Chairman, I don't want to be argumentative with my colleague, but, and he's probably right, I probably don't understand the language. I can't even imagine a situation where legislative council would disagree with a legislator, or a legislator would disagree with the conclusions of legislative council. But if I could imagine such a thing occurring, it might be over whether or not the reason that a statute was repealed or amended is something that council and legislators disagree about.
Madam Chair.
You must yes,
have
Senator
had different
Riddick.
Experiences than I've had.
Nothing in,
I hope so.
Nothing in Section 2 would in any way limit the ability to delete things from the bill. Is that correct?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Burdick, yes, that is correct.
So if the legislature had any sense that it was, you know, more substantive than procedural or whatever, we could still eliminate it. But if we wanted to add stuff, we'd have to flag it by exempting it from Section 2. That just makes sense to me.
Okay, thank you, Senator Burdick. I don't see anybody else with questions, so I'll thank you all for your testimony. And I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4133A. Members, this bill is not ready to work today anyway, because we don't have the paperwork on the -3 amendment, so we'll have to bring it back. And luckily for us, we get to meet again. So unlike other committees, today is not our last day. So that completes the bills that we have before us. Stay tuned. We are on 1 hour notice. With nothing to come before us today, we're adjourned. Before us today, we're adjourned. For notice, with nothing to